This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, the latest federal budget. Good for you or not? We'll have opinions from the government and opposition members. An update on what's happening with the group Nova Scotians for Equalization Fairness. And we'll speak with the marketing director for the Dundee Resort and Golf Club. That's all coming up in Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The federal Liberals recently brought in their pre-election budget, but the opposition Conservatives have been trying to keep national attention focused on the SNC-Lavalin affair. Sean Fraser is the Liberal MP for Central Nova. Bobby Knox spoke to him about his party's budget and the opposition's reaction to it.
Well, is it the government's hope that the budget might change the channel on the SNC-Lavalin affair?
The budget obviously isn't designed for any motive other than to lay out the government's plans to invest in Canadians. There's always something going on that you can point to in Ottawa politics that'll detract from what actions the government's taking. But certainly it's perhaps an attempt for Canadians to focus on something different. But that's not necessarily the design. Our focus is on building communities and supporting Canadians.
Now, yeah, it seems like the opposition doesn't want to change the channel. I guess some people might be wondering, you know, why doesn't the government just allow Jody Wilson-Raybould to appear before the Justice Committee one more time and, get this sorted out once and for all?
Yeah, certainly. And that's for the members of the Justice Committee to decide. The explanation that they gave publicly was there was two witnesses they did bring back for a second time, and the reason that they allowed them a second testimony was because when they went through the first round, there was no waiver of privilege that existed at the time, so they weren't able to give the same full scope of testimony that Jody Wilson-Raybould and Gerald Butts were able to give when they appeared before the committee. So the committee makes the decisions on its own. And that's the conclusion that they came to.
Is this scenario, is this setting the tone for the upcoming election? Obviously, this is the Liberals' government. This is your last budget before the election. Is the stage being set here?
To some degree, I suppose, although it mirrors very nicely the agenda that we've been implementing for the past number of years. If you look back to the last campaign, we largely campaigned on a commitment to invest in communities and to support middle-class Canadians and low-income Canadians. What you've seen over the past few years is that plan is paying off. There's over 900,000 Canadians that have a job today that weren't working in 2015, and we're seeing the benefits locally in Nova Scotia. In January and February alone, we've added 7,500 jobs to the provincial economy. The rate of unemployment is lower than it's been since we started keeping track of those statistics over 40 years ago. You look at programs like the Canada Child Benefit that put on average $6,800 into the pockets of families who received the benefit. So what you see in this budget is continued investments that build upon what's already happened. You see investments in health, in jobs, in the environment, and importantly for us in Nova Scotia, in connectivity. But you also see investment in seniors and young people. So to some degree, I suppose you could say it sets the stage. But from where I sit, the stage has been set in the 2015 campaign, and we've been continuing on the agenda that we laid out for Canadians during the last campaign.
Now, you mentioned unemployment, and although the numbers are looking good nationally and provincially, unfortunately for Cape Breton, the unemployment rate is still quite high. I think the last month it was 16.2%. What is the in the budget that may help Cape Breton with that continued high unemployment rate?
Certainly, and there's different pockets in Nova Scotia that historically have higher rates than the rest of the province and the rest of the country, and we have to ask ourselves, are we better off for the measures that have been implemented rather than are we further ahead or further behind than the groups that were always further ahead of or further behind. But when it comes to investments in employment, there's some really interesting developments. There's a $40 million program to encourage young people to join the skilled trades. There's a new Canada training benefit that will allow over the course of a person's life up to $5,000 towards where you can actually take time off work to invest in skills upgrades and training for yourself. There's new rules around parental leave to make it easier to join the workforce. There's more money for infrastructure for local municipalities that are going to put people to work. There's investments of $38 million to encourage young people to become entrepreneurs. There's also investments in tourism, which I know is a big deal for Cape Breton that'll be run through ACOA.
And I think something else that we saw, I don't know if it was in the budget, but an increase in the gas tax going to municipalities?
That's right. We've obviously, over the past few years, invested heavily in infrastructure. I know in Cape Breton you've seen upgrades to your national park. You've seen investments at the port, a number of other projects that build stronger communities in the long term but put people to work right away. Because we've had certain challenges with some provinces, and particularly because small communities have a greater difficulty affording projects, we've had a one-time top-up to the gas tax fund with $2.2 billion being injected directly into municipalities to help with projects that they need to build that are going to put people to work. So it's great news. It'll be a shot in the arm for small-town economies, and to see that the benefits are coming to Nova Scotia is a wonderful thing from my perspective.
And I know the Cape Breton Regional Municipality here has been, it's an ongoing complaint that they don't get enough equalization funding from the province, and they're shortchanged. I'm wondering what the do you have any idea? I guess the municipality here would be eligible for that increase in the gas tax to that one time.
That's right. So there, I don't have the figures in front of me, but there will be a very specific dollar amount that will accrue directly to the municipality. With equalization, you'll see that there's been an increase in the health and social transfers to the province. Of course, what the province does once they receive the equalization check from Ottawa is their business. I know as well, just while we're on the subject of transfers to the provinces, given the concerns that I hear in northern Nova Scotia around health care, we've now got the largest transfer in the history of Canada going to Nova Scotia for health care. And in addition, there's an additional $287 million for Nova Scotia alone to invest specifically in in-home care for seniors and in mental health. It's a real frustration as a federal representative when you hear people raise their concerns around the provincial health care system, and you often feel like there's things you can't do. But yesterday's budget demonstrates to me that the federal government does have a role to invest in the health of Canadians, and certainly to provide the research and the support services that allow people to be well even when they become ill.
I wanted to ask you about the national drug strategy, because I mean that is something that is important to people in our listening audience. You're establishing a Canadian drug agency, but we're not looking at a national pharmacare plan yet, right?
So this is the first step towards national pharmacare. As you'll know, we're in the middle of a process of figuring out the best way to implement national pharmacare. We've got Dr. Eric Hoskins, the former Minister of Health for the province of Ontario, is leading an advisory panel to tell us how to implement a national pharmacare plan most effectively that ensures people have access to affordable and universal pharmacare. Yesterday, with the announcement of the Canada Drug Agency, there was an important first step taken that is going to bring the cost of drugs down significantly. The way that we purchase pharmaceutical products today, we do it more or less on a province-by-province basis, and small provinces like Nova Scotia are squeezed because we don't have the purchasing power because that bigger provinces do, who can buy in bulk, by negotiating the purchase price of pharmaceutical products through the new Canada Drug Agency, will suddenly benefit from that bulk purchasing power. This is estimated to save Canadians up to $3 billion across the country on the cost of pharmaceuticals. This is a significant step in the right direction. It's not the complete plan yet, but we don't want to rush into to the design of a program when we're actively seeking the advice of experts. I expect in the coming months we'll have the implementation plan from the advisory panel laid out for us.
Your colleague Mark Eiking has sent out a release highlighting some of the things in the budget specifically for Cape Breton. He mentioned a new Marine Atlantic ferry.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I've live in Pictou County, and we've got the ferry between PEI and Nova Scotia as well, and PEI also has the Magdalen Islands ferry. The fact is, there was significant investments in Eastern Canadian ferry services. So whether it's the replacement of the Marine Atlantic project or the Holiday Island between Cariboo and Wood Islands, the government recognizes the importance to our communities and to our economies of having marine transport. To see these local investments specifically mentioned in the budget is a welcomed piece of news, and quite honestly, it's rare that you see that specific project listed in a federal budget, but to draw attention to our Eastern Canadian transportation system was something I was very excited to see.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess the Marine Atlantic Ferry is really an extension of the TransCanada.
That's right. That's right.
Do we know specifically, you know, what the plan is? You know, what ferry is being replaced, or any details at this point? Or
so, as a self-interested representative in Pictou County, I've spent more time looking at the specifics around the ferry in my own backyard. I'm afraid I don't have the specific details on what's which vessel will be added on Marine Atlantic. So I'll punt that one to Mr. Eiking. So when you next chat with him, I'll let him lay it out for you.
Okay. And well, speaking of Mr. Eiking, he's announced he's not going to be reoffering this fall, and his Cape Breton colleague Roger Cosner says he's going to mull over the decision over Easter. What are your thoughts, I guess, on the decision by Mr. Eiking not to reoffer after 18 years, I guess, as an MP for Sydney, Victoria?
You know, I got to say, we were hugely fortunate as new MPs coming in 2015 to have the experience of Roger and Mark and Scott Bryson, Bill Casey as well. These folks who've been around for literally a couple of decades. I can't say how important it was to me to have mentors of people who've seen everything there is to see in politics. Roger and Mark have had terrific careers. I know Roger's still contemplating what he's going to do, and Mark has announced this will be his last go. But Nova Scotia is better for their work. To have had their expertise and their experience around our caucus table has served me well personally, and frankly made me a better representative for my own community. One of the things I was most excited to see in the budget was a massive investment in connectivity. There's been a commitment made to connect 95% of Canadians to high-speed internet by 2026, mm-hmm. and 100% by 2030 across the entire country. There's been major investments involving billions of dollars laid out in yesterday's budget that will leverage private sector capital, and we know that high-speed internet is not a privilege. It's a necessity in rural communities, and to see the government have listened to the message that we've been peddling from Nova Scotia over the past couple of years is terrific news, and to know that the entire country is on pace to be connected in the next 10 years or so is something I think we can all be excited about.
For an opposition perspective, we spoke with former New Brunswick Conservative MP Rob Moore of Gander, Newfoundland, who is now the shadow critic for ACOA.
Well, it's a big spending budget that is spending money we don't have, and spending money we don't have today means increased taxes tomorrow. And I think Canadians have probably had enough of that kind of approach. In our own lives, we have to make sure that we don't spend more than we take in. We see provincial governments grappling with that, but the federal government just isn't following suit, isn't doing the same, and it's our future generations that are on the hook. We know that 2019 was supposed to be the year, according to Prime Minister Trudeau, that the budget would be balanced. Instead, we're seeing an almost $20 billion deficit this year with really no midterm projection for a return to balanced budget. So that's a problem. It's a problem for our competitiveness, and it's a problem for future generations. It's a problem when we're trying to provide support for families, and it binds us in the future when we're taking on that kind of debt.
Now, in opposition, of course, it's very easy to say that the budget ought to be balanced, but as you know, there are many pressures, spending pressures. Finance Department has said that the budget might not be able to be balanced until 2040. So, I mean, given those difficulties, how exactly would a Conservative government balance the budget without cutting the services that Canadians want and rely on?
You're absolutely right. It's not an easy thing to do, but the fact remains, in 2015, this government inherited a balanced budget. Our government had made the tough decisions to bring the budget into balance. During the economic downturn, we did have deficits, but by 2015, we had a balanced budget. And what we've seen since then under the Liberal government is successive and significant deficits. You know, we've seen over the last 3.5 years, as you know, in 2015, 32 Liberal MPs were elected across Atlantic Canada, and we start to look, okay, what has the results been? And one of the big opportunities right out of the gate that our government had been supportive of was the Energy East pipeline. And this government said no to that pipeline, brought in a regulation after regulation that eventually killed the project. So when we're saying that no to those kind of things and bringing in new taxes that make us less competitive, like the carbon tax, which is going to be impacting every province as of April 1st of this year, every province in Canada will be under some form of carbon tax. Those are all things that impact on our competitiveness, that can discourage investment and job growth. And those are some of the things that we've committed to changing and helping us get back to our fiscal footing and return to balance.
Now, you mentioned the Energy East pipeline. You mentioned the carbon taxes. I mean, all this is in the face of what I think most people know is the reality of climate change. And given that, what do you think should be done to deal with climate change, if not perhaps more rigorous environmental regulations or carbon taxes? What other measures do you think are appropriate?
Well, in Atlantic Canada, I don't believe that people are wasting money when it comes to heating their home, when it comes to driving their kids to school, when it comes to getting to work. We need to be encouraging investment, encouraging positive things like work, like going to school, like getting the kids to hockey. And a carbon tax isn't going to change that. When adding 10 cents per liter is not going to change that people still have to get to where they need to go. It just means that it's taking more out of the pockets of taxpayers.
But the argument is that it'll give emitters incentive to invest in new technologies that will reduce their emissions.
And I don't believe for one second we're going to see that at 10 cents per liter. So it begs the question, where is that going to go? Starting by 2022, we're going to be at about 12 cents per liter added to the price of gas in Canada. And we could see it go significantly higher. The United States, our biggest trading partner and competitor, does not have a carbon tax. So then we're dealing with our international competitiveness, the ability of companies in Atlantic Canada to compete on a global scale is impacted every time we layer a new cost on them. And then that's at the corporate level, but at the family level, many Canadian, and I'm sure you saw the study that was saying that many Canadian families, the majority, are within a couple hundred dollars at the end of each month of being out of money. So when we add on hundreds of dollars in new cost with a carbon tax and other taxes, then that impacts the ability of families to make ends meet. So combating pollution, combating GHG emissions, that can be done, and our government was doing that. Our government had a fantastic track record, I believe, on the environment. But taxing Canadians to the point where our country is no longer competitive and families cannot afford to make ends meet, that's not going to help us in the long run.
So you're talking about economic problems here, but I mean, really, the Liberal government would respond that we have record low unemployment rates across the country. The economy is growing. You know, obviously there are problems here in Atlantic Canada, but those have spanned a generation through parties of various stripes, right? I mean, the overall economy does appear to be doing well, does it not? And that's significant when you talk about our competitiveness at a national level, is it not?
No, you know, I don't accept that notion that everything is going well. It's a false economy when you have year after year of record deficits. Anyone can look like they're doing well if you are going out and maxing out your credit cards and you can be driving around in new vehicles. But at some point, the provinces are realizing this, at some point the country, you have to pay for those things. So in a year when Justin Trudeau said that the budget would be balanced, we're running a $20 billion deficit. So you know, I think when we're saying no to projects like Energy East, when we're saying no to that kind of development in Atlantic Canada, those kind of opportunities in Atlantic Canada, I think a lot of people have looked at the last 3.5 years and said, well, you know, Atlantic Canada, we elected 32 out of 32 Liberal MPs. What specifically do we have to show for that? And we've seen on any number of issues, including some as basic as, for the first time ever, the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency minister is from Mississauga, Ontario, rather than Atlantic Canada. That's a loss of voice at the cabinet table. And we've seen on issue after issue, like the summer jobs program, the business tax changes that were brought in, and major projects like Energy East, where the Atlantic Canadian view has been has not been heard. So I think that there's a lot more that we can do. We've seen the protest from the West now of the shutdown in the energy sector. That'll have an impact on all of us.
Can you really blame the government for that, though? Because, I mean, there's an international oil glut going on. Has a lot to do with shale gas capacity coming online. Whether we have these pipelines or not, there's still going to be a huge oil glut driving down prices. I mean, is the government really to blame for that?
The government's absolutely to blame for the cancellation of the Energy East project.
No, but the larger trends driving down prices.
No, the larger trends on the dollar of a barrel of oil, the cost of a barrel of oil, the Canadian government doesn't control that, but the Canadian government does control what markets we sell our oil in and our resources in. And that's why in Canada, for example, we're taking a hit when we sell oil at a discount into the U.S. rather than refining it ourselves, adding value in Atlantic Canada, which we would have been able to do with the Energy East pipeline project.
Didn't Irving say that they wouldn't be refining it, that they would just be taking it to St. John's and exporting it, and it might actually be refined elsewhere, wouldn't it?
No, Irving would also be refining some at the refinery. I mean, the Irving Oil Refinery is the largest in Atlantic Canada. It's the largest on the East Coast, and they would have been refining some of the product coming through the pipeline at the refinery.
Some of the product, but some of it, some of it would have been shipped overseas. There's no guarantee how much it would refine here, you know. And really, I mean, how many jobs would it have created in the long term? Would it have been enough to bring us back from, you know, the demographic decline and economic decline we're experiencing, do you think?
Well, there's a cumulative effect to every one of these decisions, and decisions like that are symptomatic of, I believe, of us not having a strong enough voice at the table when the federal government is making decisions. We've seen with SNC-Lavalin, of which this this budget was an attempt to change the channel on that debate that's raging right now in Ottawa. I mean, it's a significant problem that the federal government has with this issue. We've seen two cabinet ministers resign. The principal secretary to the prime minister resigned. The clerk of the Privy Council has resigned. You don't get much bigger than those kind of resignations. And we saw a government that was willing to go to the wall on that issue. But when it came to an Atlantic Canadian issue, like the pipeline, the government threw up barriers. So having the clout at the cabinet table, in my view, makes a difference. And from an Atlantic perspective, we haven't seen that over the last 3.5 years, and we don't see that in this budget.
So you asked a rhetorical question before, something along the lines of what are Atlantic Canadians getting for having elected 32 MPs. But, I mean, let me turn that question back at you because, I mean, you were a member of the previous several Conservative governments. You had almost a decade to turn back the demographic decline and economic decline in Atlantic Canada, but it went downward just as it did under previous Liberal governments, just as it's doing now. I mean, if you know, people have heard the same promises over and over again, so why should they believe you or the Liberals now when the trend has been going on for generations and nobody, including you, has really been able to put a halt to it?
Well, you know, we're talking, there's any number of things that you could be talking about there. The overall demographic decline is one issue, but the support for Atlantic Canadian families, you just look at the evidence. It's a marked departure between our government, the Conservative government, and what the Liberals have done. Our government, year after year, budget after budget, took concrete measures to help new Atlantic Canadian families make ends meet. We brought in the family tax cut that saved families $2,000 per year, lowered the GST from 7% to 6%, then to 5%, and each one of those, and brought in what was one of the biggest debates of the last decade, was how to support families with children. We brought in the universal child care benefit that lifted hundreds of thousands of Canadians out of poverty, a direct benefit to families here in Atlantic Canada. So you contrast that with the Liberals' approach, which has been to end tax credits for families, and the family tax credit, and the credit for kids that are in sports. We've seen Liberal governments raise the take up the 2% cut that we made to the GST by increasing the HST. So all those things are a cumulative effect that impact on the ability of Atlantic Canadian families to make ends meet. So there's the macro issues, the big issues, like our government supported the Energy East pipeline. The Liberals opposed it. But on the smaller scale, at a family level, our government supports making it easier for everyday hardworking families to make ends meet, and I haven't seen evidence of that from the Liberal government. And don't get me wrong, I mean, in every budget that we've brought in every budget that this government's brought in, you can, if you look far enough, there's good and bad in every budget. But when we look at the issues that Atlantic Canadians are facing right now, we're not going to find the answers in this 2019 budget. It's very much about changing the channel from the SNC-Lavalin affair. And let's face it, whenever the election is, this is an election year. And this budget and the impacts of this budget are not going to be seen or rolled out before the election.
Let's talk about some of the specific issues in the budget. I mean, because there is some money coming to Atlantic Canada. There's more money coming through the gas tax fund, for example. There's more money in general coming to young homeowners, changing the rules to allow them to take more out of our RRSPs. So obviously there is money coming to people who need it, or at least that's the claim coming from the government side. I mean, are those bad measures? What do you think of
those?
No,
but there's not money. The money from the home buyers is your own money. What the change is allowing people to do is, if you have $35,000 in an RSP and you are a first-time home buyer, you can use some more of your own money towards the down payment.
But it's increasing your buying power, for one thing.
Yeah, and that's not a bad thing at all.
And then the gas tax is a direct federal infusion of money,
but
and it's
again,
been increasing.
The devil's in the details. The money for the gas tax is not new money. This is money that was in existing programs for infrastructure that they have not been able to get out the door, so they've repackaged it in the gas tax fund.
But it's twice what they would have been getting on an annual basis, which means twice the fiscal capacity for municipalities in any given fiscal year. I mean, is that not still significant?
No, it's for 1 year, the 1 year being the election year. That's a one-time top-up for 2019, and it's not new money. It's money that municipalities would have had access to before under other infrastructure programs, but the government hasn't got them out the door. So when we were in government, for example, we had the Building Canada program, we had the community infrastructure program for smaller communities, and you have the gas tax program. What they've done is taken money out of other programs that municipalities could get funding from and put it into gas tax. So that's a decision of this government. It's only for the 1 year, and it just so happens to be the election year.
So should they not have put that money in the gas tax fund?
What they should have done is got it out the door in their other programming. Under infrastructure programs, there's dollars that are available that oftentimes on a one-third, one-third, one-third basis between federal, provincial, and municipal governments. What we've seen, the Auditor General has said that the money just hasn't gotten out the door on these programs. So in an election year, the government has taken some of that money and put it into gas tax.
Now,
and I think the gas tax fund, I mean, it's a fantastic fund. We, when we were in government, are strong supporters of it. We made it, we doubled the amount that was in the gas tax fund, and we made it permanent. And that provides funding to municipalities on their priorities. So, you know, we support the gas tax fund. We always have in government, and certainly would continue to.
Now, you mentioned before that 32 Liberal MPs were elected in 2015. Not a single Conservative MP from this region. You know, you're in the unusual position of being a shadow critic without a seat. I mean, is that 2015 election result not the best evidence one could ask for that Atlantic Canadians were displeased with your government? And if so, what do you want to say to reassure them if they might consider voting for you again?
Well, you know, the evidence is in. Like, our government, absolutely, there's going to be an ebb and a flow and tides that go up and down when it comes to support for different governments. We had been in government for 9.5 years, and Canadians voted for a change in 2015, and obviously.
But why would they if you were doing such a good job as you claim?
Well, that's for each individual person to determine. Some of them might have, you know, there was a lot of promises made by the Liberals at that time. For example, the Prime Minister had promised this year the budget would be balanced. So based on some of those claims, there's no question it's easier to make those claims from opposition than when you're in government. And those were the claims that Canadians had to balance. And a choice was made in 2015. And now we've seen, okay, we know what the Liberals said they would do. What have they done? And that evidence is in now, with whether it's the carbon tax, changes to the small business tax program, changes to the summer student program, all of these things that, in my view, haven't benefited Atlantic Canada. Well, now in 2019, Canadians will have a chance to make another decision. And that's up to the beauty of our democratic system is that's up to Canadians to decide.
The group Nova Scotians for Equalization Fairness says it will be putting the pressure on local politicians to turn out for a special meeting next month. Donnie Antle spoke to group spokesperson Al Maroon.
We found out that the federal government was giving us around $2 billion a year for all of Nova Scotia for the poorer regions. And the province had the job of taking this money and finding out which were the ones that most deserved the money. By a certain process and, you know, regulations and so on. And so they found out that over 50% of the money should have come to Cape Breton Regional. And they said there's a certain amount of that, which is about 27% almost, should go to specifically lowering the tax rate and increasing the infrastructure. So it's sort of equivalent to what's going on in Halifax and a couple of the other prosperous areas of Nova Scotia. And the other regions have their certain percentages, you know, of that money. The sad thing is that since 1982, when they first began giving out this money, it wasn't $2 billion at that time. It might have been a billion or some, but it's gone up to over $2 billion now. That money wasn't being distributed to the regions. Maybe 1% of it or something, a very, very small percentage. The provincial government was taking the money and saying, oh, it's given to us without reservation. We can use it whatever way we want to. And that's what they've been doing. So we find that Cape Breton Regional, which should be receiving about $1 billion a year, and of course that's education, that's health care, that's all the provincial services, you know, the roads, provincial roads and so on, all the things that the provincial government is responsible for, and then the other 23% or 28% or whatever it was, 27%, that had to go for specifically for the reduction of the tax percentages and the infrastructure increase, potholes, streets, sewer, and that sort of stuff, police services and so on. We haven't been getting that money. They said, oh, well, we gave you $35 million last year. Okay, so when we looked at it, we found out that $15 million of that was a grant from the province that's separate from the other equalization grant. It has nothing to do with the federal grant. It's something they gave to different regions because they were very poor. And another $15 million or whatever it was a grant in lieu of taxes. You see, EMRA, or Nova Scotia Power, is taxed on its properties here, the two big power plants and all their transmission lines and so on. And that should be coming to mostly to the Cape Breton Regional because that's where their two big power plants are, most of their transmission lines. However, they made a deal with EMRA, or Nova Scotia Power, the provincial government did, that you don't have to pay that tax, but you'll have to give us a grant in lieu of taxes, okay? And then we'll distribute it. But see, they haven't been doing that very well. I mean, we're only getting a small part of what the taxes should really be coming to us. It's our taxes. It's our property. You know, we should be getting the taxes for it. So essentially, we're giving them $3 or $4 million more in taxes we collect for different provincial taxes and giving it to the government. We're giving them that much more than they're giving us. The other money is due to us. The grant in lieu of taxes and that provincial equalization grant is due to us anyway. And the grant in lieu of taxes is very much less than what it should be. and we're giving them more money than they're giving us. So we are actually a dying organization, and I get the Chronicle Herald, and I'm seeing that the other parts of the province are starting to complain very strongly about the health conditions, the health care, you know, and so on. And not only is the province getting the $2 billion for equalization, they're getting about $1 billion for health, and they're getting $330 million for social services. And so you say, well, what are we getting here? They're closing our hospitals. They're taking away our doctors. Our doctors are leaving because they're not being paid properly. They're overworked. They're underpaid, and they're certainly underappreciated by the government. And now we're suffering. People are actually dying because of the lack of health care here in Cape Breton and the rest, in all of Cape Breton, in other parts of Nova Scotia, but mostly here. So that's what the Nova Scotians for Equalization and Fairness, we set up that group about 19 years ago. And we have all the numbers that come from the province and the federal government. There's nothing we've made up ourselves. And now we're going to have a big meeting at April the 7th at the Cedars Club. And we've invited all the political leaders to come to this. And we gave them about a month's notice. And now we're finding... They've even closed their offices. Like someone told me the other day that there was people went out to talk to Jeff McClellan in his office, and the door was locked, the mailbox was secured, and there's a lady in there working, and they were pounding on the door. She wouldn't even turn her face to face them and tell them why the place is closed. So they're not responding. Not all of them. Some of them are not responding at all to our requests. So we're going to hand pass the invitations to them. We're not getting a response through our email or telephones and so on. I have a fellow that works for me, usually from 10 to 3, Tuesday to Friday. He's doing something else right now on the outside, so he'll be here soon. He does all that work. He calls them, he sends the emails and so on, and quite a few of them are not responding. And Houston, who's the leader of the PCs and might be the next premier, maybe of a minority government, he wrote back to us and said my people, the ones that the MLAs that are PCs, have met your group, and so there's nothing new. You know, in other words, you know, what's the point of going there? We're saying, look, we're not accusing them of anything. We just want them there to hear our story and to explain to the people what they think they might do and that sort of stuff. You know, it's going to be a very, very pleasant thing. We're not inviting the public to go there because we don't want yelling and shouting and invectives and that sort of stuff. But we want them there to show up. And if they're not going to show up, we're going to have their seats with the signs on them, you know. And the last time we did that, we had that big meeting up at the Cedars Club, we took photos and we sent it on the, you know, on the, and they complained bitterly that, oh, they said we made excuses why we weren't there. Yeah, the day before they called in and said we have a previous appointment, and they were flooded with phone calls. One lady said she works for Alfie McLeod, said she went home in tears with all the phone calls that she couldn't handle, you know. People say, why didn't you go there? You know, why weren't you there? It's quite obvious you were invited and so on, so on, so on. So this time we're trying to make sure that they all are invited. The council, most of them are coming, and the MLAs and the MPs.
It's been around for a while. One of the many ventures the Cape Breton Development Corporation, or DEVCO as it was better known, tried after the mines closed. And now, the Dundee Resort and Golf Club is under new ownership and in the process of renovations and renewal. Krista Luddington is the marketing director, who tells us the new owner is interested in change.
He's originally from Texas, but just fell in love with Cape Breton and everything it has to offer. So his name is Sonny Grewal, and this will be his second full season. So we took over not last season, but the season before, about halfway through. And since then, we've seen a lot of investment, a lot of really exciting things happening on site, and things kind of getting spruced up. Of course, you know, properties, they age over the years, and so we're seeing a lot of investment going back into the hotel, into the rooms, and, you know, some surprises along the way. So we're really excited about the things happening on site, you know, between last year and then, of course, some new things on the calendar for this year as well.
So the vision of the resort, is it pretty well the same as a destination place?
Oh, absolutely. So we're looking at anything that we can do in order to experience growth, just like any other tourism business in this industry in Cape Breton. So, you know, definitely a wedding destination, definitely a place to take your family. We've got the amenities right on site, you know, between the pools, and there's even day camps happening over the summer for kids. There's live music. We've got the pub opening up again this year. So that's super exciting. And so if you're looking to, you know, host a family reunion, host a wedding, a golf tournament, like it's kind of a all-in-one package deal, right? So it's a really, really beautiful spot with lots of opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, the golf course, I have to say, as being an amateur golfer, but playing that course, it's one of the toughest on the island, but also one of the most rewarding as far as the scenery and the views from
absolutely.
The top of that mountain over West Bay and the Bedore Lake. Simply amazing.
Well, and that's it. And I mean, it really, the golf course has been carved out, you know, within the forest and the mountains. And then, of course, pretty much from every single hole, you have this breathtaking, stunning view of the Bedore Lake. And it's almost a panoramic view at some point. So it's certainly something to see if you haven't already. And for anyone listening, I strongly encourage you to book a tee time. Come on down for the day. It's nice and affordable. We've got great packages, and you won't regret it, you know, simply for the views. But the course itself is gorgeous as well. It's very well landscaped.
Now, considering our Cape Breton winters and so on, the course won't probably open till sometime either middle of April or May, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it certainly varies year to year based on the weather. So we've seen it open as early as mid-April. And the latest we've seen is the first week of May. So somewhere in between there, you'll see that course open. And, of course, the course always opens before the hotel. So even if, you know, you can't book a room yet, that's okay. You can still come on down for the day and enjoy a game of golf.
Now, is the course still as kind of a separate identity as far as being you can join as a member, right, for the folks in that area?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, and memberships are on sale now, and we've got something for everybody. So, you know, we do have a junior membership. We've got adult, senior. We have, you know, if you can only come out during the week, if you can only come out after 3 o'clock, then that's called a twilight membership. So there's really something tailored for each and every individual that wants to come out and experience the game or, you know, kind of re-spark an old passion, whatever it may be. We certainly have something for everybody.
Now, we have a keen interest, the fact that we specialize in East Coast and East Coast music, and you have done something super special by promoting a lot of East Coast music in your event schedule for the summer months coming up. I noticed that all your weekends are covered with live music, and then you've got a pub night in there as well every through the week on Wednesday, I believe.
Yeah, so every Friday and Saturday, we've got music down in our pub, Enchanter's Pub, in the hotel. And then every Wednesday, we have wing night up in the clubhouse. And so people seem to come out, they seem to enjoy it, and, you know, music is always a nice complement to any type of event. So we threw some music in there as well. They've been doing that for the past couple of years, and it's been going really well. So why ruin a good thing? We want to keep that momentum going. So we have live music every Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday from the end of May right through until closing in October.
That's amazing. So we applaud you, first of all, for supporting East Coast artists, which is great because we always need a place to play and express that music. Here's another thing, the fact that You've got a great lineup, too, of performers that will be there. It's kind of a wide variety of groups and individual artists, right?
The thing is that in Cape Breton, it seems like every second household has a musician or somebody who is just enthralled in the music scene. And so we want to showcase that. You know, there's so many folks on the island who are incredible musicians. They're just amazing in the music industry. We're really fortunate that way. We're certainly entertainment rich in Cape Breton, and so we wanted to try and pull in as many folks as we possibly can to showcase them to, you know, our guests and tourists and locals as well. You know, we do see a lot of locals coming out to Wing Night, which we're super excited about and hope that momentum continues as well. So, anything we can do to kind of support the local music scene and showcase them, we're all for it.
And that's why you're at an event venue for Kitchen Fest, which is coming up, and as well as Celtic Colors, which is coming up in the fall as well, right?
Yes, yeah, we're really excited about that partnership. We signed on with them this year as a preferred accommodation. Of course, you're seeing growth happen with Celtic Colors each and every year right across the island, and so I think it's at a pivotal point where you're going to see more and more happening in Richmond County. So people have to have a place to stay. So we're really pumped to sign on with them and excited to see what the fall will bring.
Okay, let's talk about Mother's Day weekend in particular, because this is your big launch for the summer season, and this is jam-packed with 11 performers. You've got JP, you've got Dave Gunning, along with workshops. Tell us about how that all came about.
We're trying to be strong supporters of local musicians and, you know, trying to become known as the local music hub in Richmond County. And so with that, I mean, we're fortunate in the sense that we have accommodations on site. And we wanted to kick off the season right. And there's no better way to do that than to kind of immerse ourselves in music. So the conversation started happening back in October, and things kind of started to grow really quickly. And here we are today. So essentially, it starts on Friday. Folks can, and the package deal includes a Friday night, a Saturday night. The standard package includes your breakfast in the morning for Saturday and Sunday morning, and then access to a jam session on Friday night down in the pub. And then on Saturday, there's the workshop. So we've got 4-hour-long workshops with, like you said, 11 different performers on the docket. We have like a storyteller song session. We have a Celtic Power Hour. We've got Songs by the Sea, and then an Acadian Hour to showcase Acadian culture and heritage and music. And then folks can grab supper and then roll into the Dave and JP show at 7:30 on Saturday night. That we're really, really excited about to have Dave and JP on site for that. And then there'll be an after party down in the pub after that show, and then folks will check out on Sunday. Hopefully they'll take in our Mother's Day brunch, which is also happening on site that day as well. So it is certainly a jam-packed weekend. Sales have been going very well, and we're really excited about bringing a new event, a new opportunity to Richmond County to showcase live music, and also to kick off our season.
Wow, it's a two-night package, should mention, for two people at $375. That's what it starts for the tickets, and you mentioned the breakfast and that. Plus, there's an all-inclusive package that's available too, right?
There is, yeah. And so the all-inclusive, that would be, you know, when you come in, you check in, there's going to be chocolate-covered strawberries and wine in your room upon arrival. All of your meals are included, so you have supper on Friday and Saturday night, your breakfast Saturday and Sunday morning, lunch on Saturday. And again, that's for two people as well. So if you're interested in an all-inclusive, that package certainly is available on our website. And there's all sorts of, the price varies, but if you go on, it depends on what sort of accommodation you're looking for, whether it be a standard room or deluxe or a suite or what have you.
If you're looking for more information or to book a reservation at the Dundee Resort and Golf Club, call this toll-free number, 1-844-638-6333. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can listen to a podcast of this week's show by clicking under the home button on the Coast website. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m., Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca.